Welcome to episode 7 of the Developing Life podcast. Today, we explore how immersive spaces can transform perceptions and interactions within our communities. We're joined by special guest Eric Hyman, a visionary in the design world, principal and co-founder of Volume Inc., known for innovative place-based identities and spatial activations like the Harvey Milk Memorial and the Under Ramp Park in San Francisco. Eric's diverse portfolio includes collaborations with Google, Bloomberg, and the Boy Scouts of America. He also teaches at the California College of the Arts, managing TBD at CCA, a student-staff design studio supporting local nonprofits. This live discussion, hosted by Heather Crank, will explore how Eric's leadership in design enriches communities and drives excellence in storytelling. Stick with us to learn how you can transform everyday spaces into compelling narratives that resonate with communities and inspire meaningful interactions.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Developing Life podcast. I am super excited to introduce my former graphic design professor from CCA, Eric Hyman. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me. And thanks, everybody, for coming. I see some familiar names coming up on the roster. So thanks for coming and thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So first of all, if you'd like to introduce yourself, I know True gave us some talking points, but if there's anything you'd like to share before we get into the nitty gritty, go ahead. Floor is yours.
No, I think she did a good job, other than I would make sure that, because my school would be angry if we didn't, it's the California College of the Arts, and I run this thing called TBD, which I'll just add that little correction there. But otherwise, I think it was a very nice introduction, and I think we'll get into more of what I'm about and what I do through the conversation.
Great. All right. Well, let's get started. So I first met you at CCA in, I think it was my second year in graphic design. I would love to hear about what drew you to teaching in the first place. For those who don't know anything about CCA, the instructors are required to also be working in the field as well as teaching. So everybody is highly qualified and really steeped in the San Francisco design scene. So I know you started there, but what was the bridge?
Yeah, I mean, the way I started teaching was very innocuous. You know, the graphic design department at CCA was growing, and Leslie Becker, who was the chair at the time, just called me and just said, "Hey, Eric, what are you doing? Do you want to teach this fall?" And I said, yeah, sure. You know, I always tell students, like, say yes to everything, you know, especially before you're 30, and I wasn't quite 30 yet. And so that was really the gist of how I got there. I think the reason I did it and then kept doing it was, you know, I think I always had reverence for the really good teachers, you know, from K through 12 through college. And I always felt like if it was something that I could do to sort of, you know, sort of pay it forward, I thought it would be a good thing to do. My mother was an elementary school teacher. My brother is a professor at UTEP in El Paso. And so I think that there's this kind of teaching thing that runs probably genetically through me as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I also think too, one of the great things I loved about being a student was just engaging in the discourse that school allows you to engage in. I think that I come from a family that was very interested in that from when I was a small child. And so to be able to continue that in the guise of an instructor or teacher was very appealing. Certainly the crux of teaching and how I do it has certainly evolved, especially, you know, since you were a student many, many years ago. So, you know, I think definitely things have evolved, but I think that core inspiration is really about, you know, dialogue and wanting to sort of, you know, both give people knowledge, but also, you know, do it in a way that I selfishly get something out of too. Mm-hmm. So
when she called you to ask you to teach, how did she know about you?
You know, I left that out. I was actually a student, an alumni of CCA too. And Leslie was one of my instructors. And You know, I really loved being at CCA. It was really a wonderful few years, and especially to find the sort of thing that I wanted to be doing. And so I think that she felt that it was something that I could gravitate towards and do. And so I appreciate the little nudge that she gave me way back in the 20th century.
So I know when I was a student, you taught one way. Today, the landscape is so incredibly different. So, how have you changed the way that you're teaching beyond just the basic design principles? And how are you going to prepare your students for what's happening today?
Well, I think the first big thing that's really evolved is I think when I was a student, and maybe even when you were still a student, I was starting to teach, it was very much, I think, this sort of master apprentice kind of thing. It's like we have the knowledge and the skills, and you know, we're pros at this, and we're going to kind of give you the knowledge that we have to kind of help you do this. And I think over time, I've realized that it's more of an exchange. I see it as this kind of maybe have a bit more experience in certain things, but you as students in your experience bring a lot to the table. And I just want it to be more of an exchange rather than this sort of, I know how to do this. And I always prided myself as I went along, like when the work would go up on the wall at the end of a semester, that you could not really see my hand in it. You know, I think it was more about me trying to pull out of the students, you know, their voices and having them come to the fore. And so while I'm not really teaching those classes as much anymore, I think I still take a lot of pride in trying to do that. I always challenge myself to like never do anything but ask a question and critiques and stuff. And the students drive them crazy, but I think this idea of trying to get them to have agency and own a little bit more of their education and me just being a guide, I think is just more apropos to these times. I think the other thing is, you know, I use this kind of cliched saying called human first, designer second. And it's really sort of three prong. I think the first one is just, you know, the TBD class I teach is all about kind of doing work for these local nonprofits. And, you know, the idea there is can we sort of point our work towards maybe things that are a bit more important to us as a community or as human beings is one. I think it's also getting them to really begin to think about how does the work live in the world, you know, outside of them, and how does that context sort of inform it? In other words, asking more about the why and the who and the where rather than so much on the what and the how. And then, you know, I think that the last part is just really getting them to understand that, like, design as I see it, the wonder of design is that it's never just about you. Right. It's really about how it sort of intersects with these contexts or these people or these constraints that you have. And that's what makes it fun and interesting. And so, I think that getting them out of this, I think up to this point, they're really kind of in their own heads for a lot of it and trying to kind of pull them out of that a little bit and kind of be like, look, this stuff lives in the world and we need to think about that. And then I would say the last thing about that little phrase is that I also want to encourage them to not think that design is sitting behind a computer all day or sketching all day, that it's really informed by life. And as this former classmate of mine used to told me once, his real name's Jason, but he calls himself Treebeard. He said, you know, good ideas come from life. You know, we did good studio work and stuff, but we knew when to go out and sort of fuck off and, you know, really just experience life. And that's where all the ideas come from. And so getting them to kind of really not make design the end all be all, that it just, it's part of a larger mosaic in their life. And if you let it, you know, it can be informed and become really interesting from the stuff you don't do as a designer, but you actually do outside of it. So.
So do you mean like saying no to certain projects? Is that sort of what you're alluding to?
It's saying no to certain projects, I guess. I mean, that certainly could be one of it, but I also think it's just sort of maybe just not buying into this idea that I need to be working all the time to succeed. That we all need to kind of take a break and walk outside and experience other things. And I just always know, I always carry a little sketchbook with me because I know the aha moment's never going to happen while I'm at my desk. And nine
Yeah.
times out of 10, it never does. It's always like, oh my God, that's it. And I have to pull out something and kind of like write it down and then make sure when I get back to the office, I or home, I remember it. 'Cause I just feel, my friend Scott Stoll, who runs this great firm called Open, his book about his firm's work is called Design is for People. You know what I mean? And I always just love that simple thing. Like, human-centric design as a term always kind of implied this idea of like, oh, we're working so much in technology, we forgot that it's about people. But I always like Scott's just like, design is for people. And I always add like, not Pinterest in parentheses sometimes. But otherwise, that's, I think it's easy when you're in the in the mix, and it's to forget that sort of simple, part of it. And that's for me what makes it so exciting.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so beyond teaching at CCA, you opened up a studio called Volume. I'd like to hear about why you got started, why you opened your own space, and what kind of projects. I mean, you've kind of hinted at it, more humanitarian type projects, but I'd like to hear more about your reasoning and your drive behind it.
Yeah, it's funny. I think starting Volume was really a majority of just naivete, in the sense of, there weren't as many options to slot in as a designer when I was there. It was like there were like a bunch of really cool small studios. There was maybe some ad agencies and maybe like one or two in-house departments that I didn't want to work for. And so, I remember I just bumped into Adam, my business partner, at a mixer. We had both just kind of finished up a bunch of jobs because the first dot-com crash had hit and everything was going sideways. And we just kind of met a few times and thought like, hey, this is interesting. We kind of have philosophically, we, because I knew him in passing, but not super well. We had like these philosophical things that were very aligned, but had very different sort of skills and felt like maybe together we could sort of do something. And then in hindsight too, I do remember Jennifer Jurdy, who runs this great firm called Elixir Design in San Francisco. They wanted to bring me on full time at some point, and I said, I don't think I want to work full time anywhere. And then she said to me, she's like, you need to start your own thing. And I was like, nah, I don't think so. And she's like, yeah, you should. And Jennifer is so wise, and she was almost like my grad school working for them. And she was right. And I think, when we started Volume, we did have a vision in the general sense. Like I was reading through our first promo book and reading the language and going like, yeah, like it's still this, but it took a while, I think, to work out the specifics. I think that when you're starting off a firm, especially during a giant recession, you're kind of taking anything you can get and you're not being too discerning. And I think we always tried to put our layer of what, how we thought it should be done over it. And I think we always did a good job of that. But like we were doing little identities, we were doing sort of weird pro bono stuff, we were doing freebies for the AIGA. There were these random sort of temporary exhibits that we were doing for companies, because my Adam used to work on primarily these sort of trade show exhibit type work. And it was very random, but we did try to go after things like the whole, like I had never done an exhibit catalog or any kind of book stuff outside of school before this. And I kind of made a conscious effort to go after that stuff. And we started to get more of that. And then I think it just sort of snowballed over time. And then, as I was saying, I think a little bit earlier to you, right before the pandemic, Adam and I sort of decided like, we do this sort of kind of multi-dimensional architecture slash with graphic design thing really well. And I think we could own this a little bit more, as opposed to competing with all the big kind of branding agencies and smaller branding firms. And there's a lot of designers out there now. And so I think we just decided like, let's just put a stake in the ground and kind of try to own this and see where it goes. And with COVID hitting right in the middle of that, it was bumpy, but I feel like we've hit this kind of cruising altitude now that that is exciting, and I think it goes back to that philosophy, like we had these kind of core things that we wanted to sort of realize, and it's working now.
It's interesting because We've had a lot of inflection points, one right after another, and we're hitting another one creatively right now with the whole AI disruption. Are you affected by that at all in your business, or is it, have you built your niche in a way where you're sort of insulated?
Man, you know, I certainly have been following it, that's for sure. You know, I feel like this could be as seismic a change as like the Macintosh was for our, and anybody who did design before that whole Macintosh change turned over, it was big. You know, it made, I mean, I would say it was a net positive, no doubt, but it put a lot of people out of work and changed a lot of workflows. And but I think design, if design was resilient and sort of stayed, I don't know. It's hard to know right now what this AI thing is doing. I mean, I think right now for designers, it seems to be like these amazing sort of image maker things that can really sort of create a lot of options in image making. And I would say our work has moved away from a lot of that sort of singular image making and more into this sort of systems building and in systems building and environments, which is a little bit more complex, I think. But I'm not under any illusion that that AI can't, you know, sort of begin to disrupt workflows and maybe in a, you know, hopefully in a good way too. But you know, I think there's two things that come to mind on this. The first one, and on the good side, is that, you know, I've always been preaching like we should, you know, design fetishizes craft too much sometimes. We should be focusing on, like I said, the why, the who, and the where, and not so much about what it is all the time. And I don't know if AI sort of frees us up to kind of think about things, you know, in bigger ways and to address the more complex part of our work, then hypothetically, I'm on board, you know. But as a teacher, I think a lot about this idea of like, what happens when, you know, all the students do is like type a few prompts in and they are given this stuff. I mean, part of learning how to make see what we see as designers is kind of making it somewhat with your hands, I think. I mean, I kind of want to believe that. And it seems really like an interesting inflection point that that suddenly would be diminished in favor of just typing these prompts in. So as a teacher, I'm a little bit like, huh, you know, I don't really know what the right way to go is. And, you know, right now it doesn't seem like that stuff can really kind of create really complex systems yet, but I'm pretty sure it will. And when that happens, it's going to be interesting, to say the least. And, you know, I hope that my creativity is resilient enough to that it that even the tools, if they get really strong like AI, it'll still be valuable. But do I just want to be a sifter? Is that what we're all going to be, designers? We're going to be sifters now? I mean, I'm sort of like, is that what I want to be doing? I mean, I don't know, but you know, it's so early right now, and at the same time, it's moving so fast. I'm loath to make any predictions because I'm like, I've always been wrong when the predictions thing come around. The reason why I wouldn't be wrong again. So,
I'm with you there. It's moving so fast. I'm kind of trying to stay relevant, but at the same time, I can't quite keep up. So, yeah, in a year, I think we'll all be in a very different place. Another question I have for you around working at volume, your project that you did for the memorial of Harvey Milk, I would love to hear you talk about the process and the motivation, and how you engaged the community.
Yeah, I mean, I think before I even get started, I think we have to, I have to acknowledge that, you know, SWA, the landscape architecture firm that really is kind of the driving force in terms of managing the project, especially, I think are, you know, need to be applauded here because they have really have spearheaded this whole thing. And I think they were also very sort of, I think it's rare that an architect or landscape architect will come in and come to a firm like us and go, we see you as equal partners in this creatively. Usually it's kind of, well, the architects have the are in charge and they kind of like, okay, here's what we're thinking and we want your magic here, but it's already set. So first, I think that they from the beginning, from pitching the job, they came to us and said, you know, we want your input on the pitch because we think you guys have a beat on this in a way that, because it had gone through a lot of cycles. There have been a lot of designs for this thing and they've all failed. And I think part of it was that it was driven primarily by this, for lack of a better description, kind of like architectural sort of thrust rather than sort of an experiential storytelling one. And they had seen me present about other projects we had done for Bloomberg. And we're like, huh, these guys could bring that angle to this that's necessary. And so we pitched for it together and kind of, that was the first part, you know, that we did the pitch together. And that's why we got it, I think, is because we were equal in terms of informing it. And then, you know, in terms of engaging the community, you know, they engaged a third party to kind of help. And this was during COVID too. So it was tough. So we're having these sort of, they already had done a bunch of stuff the years before, but we had to kind of restart it. And so they engaged this third party organization that I'm so apologetic for not remembering their name right now. But, and they sort of set up these kind of community meetings, where they could sort of participate in you know, imagining this thing, and we kind of set up these frameworks, and I think that went a long way. I think for any project like that, you know, this sort of designing with, not for, at least in the beginning, is really important, and I think that got us a lot of goodwill. And then in terms of the actual design, you know, I think that you know, it was a little kind of like, who's doing what? Not really sure. You guys are landscape pros. You guys are the design pros. You know, we kind of throw ideas together and there were a few kind of random things, but we always had this sort of one thing, which we had in the pitch, which was everybody talks about Harvey Milk, about this being this beacon of hope. And I think the angle we brought was like, look, the rest of the quote says he doesn't want the move. He wants the movement to continue. So the other corollary is that it has to always be hope and action. And that became the sort of driving force of this, that everything we do has to embody that dynamic of engendering hope, but also providing sort of a blueprint for how you act upon that hope. And so a lot of the design sort of spun out of that. And then, you know, I'd always seen these photos of Harvey Milk with these holding, you know, these placards and I protest with placards. And I had done this little sketch that had this like little beacon thing that had all these placards on them. It was a really, you can see it on our website. I think it's just like this little rough sketch. And I showed it to the partner at SW and he goes, that's it. That's it. We're doing that. That's what we need. That's the hub. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, that's it. And it was like, okay. And to their credit, man, they figured out all the sort of functional stuff that, because it's a really difficult site. It's above a muni station. There's a lot of ADA requirements. It's a very busy intersection. I mean, they not only brought artistry to the landscape, but figured out all the functional stuff too. And so now we're about to go into this whole, you know, can we fund it? Can we make it sort of period? But, but I think that it's been an amazing collaboration. And I just have to applaud them for even having the prescience to know that the combination would be a good one. And so, you know, I encourage people to go to the site and see there's a lot of different parts. Like I talk about this for a whole hour, but, but I think they really saw that we could bring that experiential storytelling thing in a way that would be very meaningful. That would add that last layer that would make this thing more than just the normal monument. That's like this piece of concrete that has a name on it. And, you know, like we're used to.
Do you feel like the collaborative process for you, in addition to the architecture firm and the people who came in to work out the logistics for you, do you feel like working with the community was a really important part? And do you aim to do more of that work in your future?
Well, I mean, the community is definitely still going to be involved in this process for, you know, what's going to be in that exhibit on this mezzanine level below it. And you know, I think really the success of that was us kind of giving them a scaffolding to kind of react to, and then them sort of confirming for the most part what we thought it should be. And it's not to say that they didn't do anything. It didn't surprise us. There was a lot of nuance in the community stuff that I think added a lot to how we thought about some of the things. Like one of the early designs had like names or something on the ground. And somebody said, like, these are important people. I don't want to step on them, you know?
Oh.
And I was like, oh yeah, that's a really good comment. You know, like we always see those bricks and think, oh, that's cool, you know, but that was a really good comment. Just as one example. And I think that that's the kind of nuance that working with the community, I think, can bring to the design if you're open to it. But it's a navigation for sure. I mean, it was a long process in getting people on board, and it's still going to be a process because there's still a lot to be done. You know, all that sort of text that's going to go on the monument is going to have to go through the community, and really we're going to have to talk to them about, like, what's, you know, what are the words that should be here, you know, whether it's Harvey's words or otherwise. So
what's the completion date? Do you have one?
Yeah, I don't. You know, I know that there's an elevator that needs to be built on that Muni site before we can even start. And I don't think that's supposed to be done till next year. So I'm guessing it's like 2026, 2027. This is the flip side of moving back to being, because I started in architecture. And this is the flip side of that. It's like, oh, this instant gratification that we get as graphic designers is gone on these projects. It's going to be like, I hope I still have a business by the time this thing gets done, you know?
Yeah, when AI takes over.
Yeah, or we still exist as humans. Yes, we could go that far too.
Right. I'd also like to dig into your community work with TBA. So how did that TBA come about? Like, what motivated you to start that? Was that part of your requirements in being a teacher? And why do you pick local charities?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's TBD.
Sorry, TBD. TBD. Sorry.
It's okay. No worries. I know how that... get an earworm and you can't lose it. I mean, what was interesting is that the graphic design department had always had this program called Sputnik, where the students would do real work for the school. And coincidentally enough, I was the very first Sputnik student back in 1995. And what it was, and it was a cool program because you got to work on real projects. They would get printed, or you'd see them around school. It was really great. And then CCA decided to do like a professional brand for the school. And they really kind of clamped down on, like, anything that goes out of the school needs to have this branding thing. And Bob Offaldish, my colleague who had taught this class pretty much the whole time, just wasn't interested in kind of executing brand standards. And so he's like, I'm out. And so the chair, Rachel Berger, came to me and said, hey, we need to find a replacement to this. Are you interested? And I said, yeah, of course. I was a member of it. I taught it once or twice when Bob was on sabbatical. And we kind of hatched this idea of, like, hey, because I was really frustrated at volume. You know, the economics were getting very Darwinian. We couldn't take on these pro bono jobs like we used to. And there were all these great organizations that I wanted to do work for that just couldn't feasibly kind of find the time for and keep the doors open. And it just seemed like a win-win. It's like, oh, the students could get real world experience, and these organizations that would normally not get design at all, get these services that could really help them. And so it just felt like a no-brainer once we kind of landed on it. And, you know, really all due credit to Rachel, who was just put everything behind it, says do what you want to do. And I have to say, it's probably been the most demanding, but also the most rewarding teaching experience I've had, mostly because it's where my head is right now in terms of a designer. But then I'm just also watching the students kind of make this turn. Like, they're really frustrated with me until they present their work for the first time to the clients. And the clients always love it. They love it so much more than any instructor. And they're just like, oh, wow. Like, I'm not going to get hammered on this, because I'm really hands off on the design part of this thing. And you know, I kind of say, you guys are pros now. I'm not going to be an art, you know, I'm not going to be like a normal design teacher. And I think that they just, oh, wow, this is great. And then seeing the work go out into the world, and even if it's just a very small thing, I think it's exciting for them to see it be real. And and see it be real for, I mean, these organizations that I think go beneath the radar, but are really kind of the glue of our communities. You know, I think we kind of forget that these nonprofits are really doing this kind of work that sort of makes our lives living in the Bay Area really awesome. And they just don't get the sort of attention they deserve. And it's just nice to also shift the students' minds about, like, hey, you don't just have to do work for Google. You know, you can actually do work for these other organizations and make a different kind of impact if you so choose. And so I think that's been really exciting. You know, like I remember
Mm-hmm.
we did this stuff for BART and they were all in the BART cars and, you know, we took a field trip and we like rode BART to try to find the, you know, we found one. We're like, oh my God, there's your stuff. You know, it was just like one of these things where the, you know, the students were just like, whoa, you know,
Yeah.
they're really excited. So.
So, would you consider yourself a humanitarian, Eric?
Well, if I guess if I said no, it would make me a sociopath. You know, humanitarian is that kind of word that I kind of treat like artists. You know, like I do humanitarian things, but I would be loath to call myself that because I feel like humanitarians are like the people that are like doctors without borders that go to like war zones and like take care of people. You know, I make art every so often, but like artists are like those people make the commitment to be artists, so I loathe to call myself that too. But so the word I would say is I probably I'm more like a humanist, maybe is a better word to kind of use. And I use humanist because my definition of that is that you put goodwill towards your fellow man, woman, them over any ideology, right? And I think that that's something that I think in a lot of what's happening in the world right now with polarization and just awful things around with Donald Trump on down, you know, it's hard to find. And you know, this is maybe a product of my age too, that I'm not as black and white about things, but it's like, I think when humanists and liberals let go of the empathy quotient, it's kind of not liberal anymore. It's kind of not empathy anymore. And, you know, I think, you know, I have relatives that support certain causes that I don't believe in that are really bad or whatever. And it's like, am I just supposed to hate them now? You know what I mean? I just feel like in some ways, TBD is an extension of that. It's like, I want to kind of fix the one-to-one, because I think if we fix the one-to-one, the micro, we can fix the macro. But if we can't just sit in the same room with someone who has different opinions about these very kind of volatile issues right now, like how can we expect anything to improve? And I think design has a place in that, you know, to a degree, in the sense of, you know, when we design these very simplistic political posters, they aren't really helping anything. To me, you know, they're kind of simplifying things to our detriment, you know, or if we're creating technology that sort of allows us not to interact with each other, but instead skip that, if you want to skip to like UI UX, I feel like that's problematic because it's really sort of eroding sort of the human contract for lack of a more modest term. And so to me, I think it's more, I'm a humanist designer rather than a humanitarian designer is maybe the way I would sort of characterize it.
That makes perfect sense. So if you were to address the lack of human connection with a lot of the technology, I think partly in response to the pandemic, but also it's now ramping up with the advent of AI, the human element, the human touch, the human mark is sort of at this point of maybe disappearing or becoming less important for a period of time. And I often wonder if we're going to end up swinging back the other way once it becomes hyper real, hyper perfect, easily executed. I would love to hear your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think as human beings, we just crave, you know, in the flesh connection. We crave sort of, you know, things that, you know, we can touch and feel good. It's like, you know, when we see design work or you can see the remnants of the human hand, it's like we're just kind of intuitively attracted to it, or at least I am. I don't want to use my anecdotal experience as the end all be all, but I don't know. I just feel like there's something primal about being able to see, you know, a mark that you know was made, it is imperfect in a way that was made by a hand, right? And I think if we start with that fundamental place and kind of blow that up, you could apply that everywhere to a certain degree. You know, I think about What's a good example of this? You know, I just think about these moments of connection that were very surprising in the wake of COVID. The joke that I always make is that we're at that point now where we need to go back out and actually go to the party. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know how it is, sort of like, oh, I don't feel like, oh, I don't want to go
Yeah.
to practice tonight. I don't want to do that. And then you go and it's like, oh my God, I am so glad I went. And I feel like in some ways that's a metaphor for, you know, we need to like, no, I'm not going to do DoorDash tonight. I'm going to go out to a restaurant, right? I'm not going to
Yes.
sit down on the computer first. I'm actually going to draw something. I'm not going to text somebody. I'm going to call. I sound like an old man saying this right now, but I feel like that's what really was tough about COVID for me was that it turned me into an introvert because I didn't feel like I had any other option. And I feel like coming out of COVID and then the potentially of AI making things so impersonal and accelerating things. And granted, there are these macroeconomic forces that I'm not even talking about right now that is a part of this. But I don't know. I just feel like we all need to quote unquote go to the party, you know, get messy, like not be afraid of the sort of we don't know what's going to happen. And friction is good. And, you know, like all that stuff, like you said, it would be nice to see a pendulum swing back. But, you know, I don't know. I feel like I might be a minority in that, but and I think that's why I really love the work that I'm doing is that I can see it and I can touch it and I might even be around for a while. And I think in the context of where we've been, it becomes even more exciting to try to get that work out there and done, you know.
You
So
know, I was speaking to a friend this morning and she brought up a really good point to me. She said back in the 1900s when portraits were painted and then the camera came on the scene, and it started to replicate portraits perfectly. So people moved away from creating portraits because the money in it was no longer there. And they began impressionism and more modern abstract art. And part of me is curious if once AI is able to replicate everything in this hyper-realistic way, what that will leave room for in our next iteration of exploration. I would love your thoughts on this.
throwing the fastballs right down the middle.
I taught
Yeah,
from the best.
I mean it's yeah, touche, touche. Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I had a history teacher in architecture school that like made us memorize like two dates. It was like the birth of Mozart and the creation of photography. You know, and I think about like that a lot, like that photography, what a lightning bolt that was, and that you could see things for real. And in some ways, you could argue maybe this is the equivalent of that. You know, past that, it's like I don't know. You know, the one thing that's interesting right now is that I don't like the AI aesthetic very much. And it'll be interesting to see how that evolves because I don't know, maybe I'm just more of a flat, you know, more minimal, less Baroque kind of thing. But I've been seeing so much of this AI sort of art and been like, yeah, it's cool, but it's not my thing. So what happens to all these people who are like, this isn't my thing? You know, what like are we gonna try to use AI or are we gonna rebel? I don't know. You know, I mean, I just I think the other part of it too that's kind of interesting is just that where does the sort of what's the word I'm looking for? The ownership and the new begin is another sort of like, do we as instructors, as teachers, as designers need to be a lot more forceful? I mean, there's part of me, it's like, yeah, people steal all the time. Maybe this is the end game of that we can't really control that. At the same time, there might be an opportunity in terms of, okay, it's like producing all this stuff that, you know, looks a certain way. What if we sort of push back a little bit and be like, what about this? And let's in the course of that, I'm making a lot of sense. In the course of that, make AI a little bit more ethical in the way that it evolves. I don't know. I think the cat's out of the bag, the Pandora's box is open. I don't know how you do that, but yeah, there's a lot that's been swimming in my, I just feel like in the last 2 weeks, there's been so much discussion about this. And I don't really, you know, I just feel like predictions at this point are kind of a fool's errand, you know? And that the only thing we can do is sort of trust our instincts around what we think is right as both just people and as creative people, you know? I want to hold on to some of those things that are, you know, I think this happens a lot, like technology's come along and then what are the durable things that we need to keep doing and what are the things that we need to stop? Like we don't need to hire a typesetter anymore, but good typography is still important, right? Just to use a very base one. You know, I think we're going to need to be a lot more aware, you know, of like what are these things that are really durable that we need to keep and what are these things that maybe we can let go of. And I just have no idea what that is yet, you know.
All right. I have one last question for you here before we open it up. If anybody has any questions in the meantime, feel free to drop it in the chat. So what do you think the difference is between being influenced and stealing somebody's work? Where's the line?
You know, I had this teacher in architecture who said, you know, influence is okay, but you need to transform it, not transfer it directly. Now that's very vague, but it's this kind of thing that I think the corollary to that is something that I often tell students. It's like, don't worry so much about making it new, worry about making it yours, you know, because I think that if you inject enough of yourself into the work that you're doing, even if you're being inspired by something formally that you love, I think as long as you're injecting it with your own kind of point of view in some sort of way and addressing the context in which it appears and whatnot, then I think the influence is probably okay. But if you're just like stealing an image willy-nilly because your project's due tomorrow and you add some type at the bottom, you know, that feels like stealing to me because I don't know. I've never been sort of a formalist in the sense that I've always tried to wanting to innovate form. That's never been my jam. To me, it's always been the form has always been part of like, well, what's, you know, certainly trends affect you whether you like it or not, but it's just like, what's the context? What's the project? What's who's it for? Like, what are going to be the words on it? You know, that's always been the thing that's driven me to create visual form for lack of a better distinction. And so I've certainly been influenced by people like, I don't know, Vaughn Oliver and Tibor Kallman, and I don't know, I'm just trying to name some designers that I love. Lucile Tanasis, you know, that I loved as a student, but I've always kind of just used it as this more of a spirit that influences me and less like, let's just take it because I'm feeling lazy. But you know, I don't know if that sort of morality, for lack of a better description, exists anymore. I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, I also don't want to steal it because I kind of feel like it feels lame to just steal something. You know, I don't know if people have that same kind of, you know, what's the right word I'm looking for? Those rules, those guardrails.
So you think stealing equals lazy?
Well, you know, there's always that famous quote, like Picasso says, you know, amateurs, what is it? Amateurs borrow, artists real, artists steal, or whatever. It's so vague, though. You know what I mean? It's like, it's obvious that guy didn't just steal stuff. He, like, made it his own, right?
It's true.
You know, I think there's a fine line, but I think it's sort of like the judges with pornography. It's like, you know it when you see it. You know what I mean?
Yes, true. Yes, good point. Okay, I've got a question here from my friend Devron Chevron, and he is asking, what are three powerful pieces of advice you give to designers concerning how you approach designing experiences And how do you prioritize the needs and emotions?
Wow, good question. I think one of the big shifts that happened in designing experiences is that, in architecture, they always talk about, the site and how your work should be site specific, take cues from the site, which to me is taking cues from the context, right? And I think that graphic design, whether it's branding or this digital world, kind of operates in this very abstract space. And so for me, what really kind of cracked open with a lot of this environmental work was like, what happens when you have this very specific context, whether it's an office or a site or a city? How does these sort of hard and fast sort of brand rules that we always like to impose on things shift, when it happens? One of the examples I sometimes use in lectures is like the city of Sedona said to McDonald's, "We have sort of colors that we like in this city, and so you can't have golden arches. You can make them cerulean blue, you can make them brown, but no red and black." And I was like, "That's kind of cool." I was like, "That's pretty awesome." And so I think in a nutshell, it's like, how can the environment, whether it's the actual place or the people that work there or whatever, sort of inform and shift the way you might design something if it was simply in this kind of hypothetical vacuum? I think the second thing with that is that I think every site, every project has these sort of stories that I think are embedded. And I think we are always looking, no matter how functional they may, the initial ask may be, how can we sort of unearth these sort of stories that are either from people that are already there, from the history or whatever, that could maybe kind of create a little bit more interest in the project. We did this project for Brooklyn Basin where we did a lot of history and kind of convinced the client, like, why don't you have this tiny little history walk so people can discover these little moments about the history of this place, because it's most people didn't even know it existed before they redid it. And then I think the last part is, and I we what the digital has wrought, I think, a little bit, is this idea that we can participate in things. We have these platforms on digital that we can contribute to. And I think we're always also looking for opportunities for people to kind of participate. And I use that word very broadly, from like, oh, we actually sort of give them something that makes them stop and contemplate like a bigger question than just the immediate parochial sort of functional or brand domains. But it could also be things that they actually get to do. Like the Harvey Milk thing has this proposal where when you come up out of the Muni, there'll be this little kiosk where you'll get this little card that'll pop out of it and have this artwork of flowers on one side and then this sort of activist sort of charge on the other. And the flowers is from the story that when Harvey Milk died and they had this service form, there were all these flowers. The people at the service says, "Take the flowers out of here. We want nothing alive here to live in this church. We want you to take it out and give the flowers to people outside to remember Harvey." And so we wanted to recreate that experience in the memorial in some way. So I think we're always thinking about how that can be a contingent part of it too. And so I would say those are maybe the three things that we, the three sort of methods that I think we employ the most.
Wow, that's super powerful. I didn't know that about the flowers. Really beautiful. I have a question here from our friend Liesl. She's asking, what changes are you noticing in commissioning, as in how are clients, their briefs, and how are they interacting in the creative process? How's it changing? And what do you think is better, and what do you think is more challenging?
I would say in our work, what's interesting about client briefs is that we are often part of a larger mosaic of things that need to get done. Like, hey, we have this whole development, we're building this building and this whole landscape park, and you are going to create this sort of storytelling wayfinding layer. I think what's happening a lot, and I would say this probably happens for regular jobs too, is that clients are increasingly less sure about what they need exactly. And so we are having to often add this kind of additional layer of like, okay, the general ask is that we need this kind of storytelling layer, but what is it exactly? And so we're often asked to kind of define these things in a little more concrete terms. But I would say even something like branding, I think, when I was young, it was like, oh, when you do an identity, it's like you have a letterhead and maybe you have some signage over your form. And there was this very fixed kind of things. And now it's so wide open. There's so many kinds of applications. And so I think the briefs, and I think the firms that are sort of stepping into this sort of vacuum are the ones that are succeeding, in a well. They're not only kind of giving you the thing, but they're actually telling you what the thing needs to be in the first place. So I think to me, that's a big change. And I think that's why a lot of these firms like IDEO and Frog that were even backing up even further and just going like, here's what your business should be, period. I think there's just a lot more uncertainty. There's not as many fixed things anymore. And so we are kind of tasked with kind of figuring out what the whole framework is in addition to designing what goes on the framework itself. And so that's pretty exciting, right? It's hell to try to estimate to make sure you get paid enough money to do it. That sucks, but we've gotten better at that, I think, as we've done more of this and know what to anticipate. But I think that open-ended stuff can also put you in a hole really quick financially if you're not careful. So I like the more open-minded thing. I find that to be the better thing, but it can also be challenging from just a practical standpoint.
Do you create the budget yourself, or do you have someone come in and help you, or?
We used to have somebody who was good at helping us, but they kind of gave us a methodology, and now we've gotten pretty good at figuring it out. We try to track people's hours pretty well. We've done it a few times now to know that it's going to take this long. And with that, there's a certain fee. And of course, we're going to charge a bit more of a premium because, no offense, I think we do it better than a lot of people. Yeah, it's let me just tell you, this running volume has been awesome. I wouldn't do anything else, but it's a constant learning experience. It's a constant, you have to constantly be ready to, learn new things and pivot and, it's both exhilarating and terrifying every day.
I get that. So in the next 5 years, if you were to project yourself into the future, where do you see yourself?
Yeah. I saw that question earlier. Yeah. It's so funny you bring that up because I'm sort of like, okay, I definitely want to 5 years of what I'm doing right now, I want to see where it goes. And then after that, I'm going to take stock and see, it's like, do I want to keep doing this? Do I want to retire? Do I want to just shift it? I don't think I'm one of those people that wants to die. I'm not like this Frank Lloyd Wright is like, I'm going to design buildings till I'm 95 and die at my desk. It was always the example we were given in architecture school. And, the guy pulled the Guggenheim out of his ass just before he died. So right on, dude. But I don't know if I'm that kind of person, running a business takes a lot out of you. And it would be nice to kind of have that burden taken off me for a while. And just to, what would I do if I didn't have to worry about that? And, so I think I want to entertain the question of, if I didn't have these sort of very practical demands on me, which feasibly may be feasible in 5 years, I don't know. What would I do? You know what I mean? I think that's it's a question that I want to ask much more seriously when I feel like I can. But I think for the next 5 years, I really want to focus on, where's this going to go? Because it's exciting. Like, I got to tell you, 2 or 3 years ago, I was like, yeah, maybe this is over. Maybe I got to just pivot somewhere else. And then suddenly we're working on all this stuff where I'm just like, I don't know how to do this. And it's so cool. And wow. I just feel like getting the candy store again, when I first started design school. And so I want to see where that goes, but do I have the energy to keep going into my, I'm not even going to say my age, but do I have the energy, to keep going? I don't know. Right now I do, but we'll see.
Okay. So we have 5 minutes left. If anybody has anything they would like to ask Eric, now is your opportunity. I'm just going to give people just a second.
Don't be shy.
Don't be shy. I could keep going.
Yeah, she has a lot of questions.
I have lots of questions, so many questions. Okay, so I'm going to come back to one other thing. I want to talk about the spark. You were kind of alluding to it just now, like you don't know if you're going to have enough energy or where you'll be in 5 years, but and you're learning so much and your spark has kind of been reignited. What would that look like for you if you the projects came to you like you're working on now and they became bigger and more involved and more inspiring? Do you know what kind of work that would be? Do you want to entertain that? Or do you really just want to kind of trail off into the night?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, my bucket list project was always to design the memorial. That was it.
Really?
And then when we got this job, I was like, wait a minute. Like, what? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I have this vivid memory of like, my dad took us to see the Vietnam Veterans Memorial when it opened.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I don't know, 11 or 12. And I never forgot. I was walking up, like watching these grown men kind of touch this wall and start crying. And it was just like one of these things where just like, fuck, it never left me. And I always, you know, over time and as I learned more, and I remember in architecture school, they took us to see it again. And it was equally as powerful. I thought, man, like if I could ever do something like that, that would be awesome. And now I'm here and I hope it's good. And so now I'm just like, shit, like what's next?
Yeah.
You know, it's a really good question. And I don't necessarily think bigger is better. I think there are a few sort of signposts of success that were sort of fed, especially as graphic designers and maybe architects too, that that bigger is better, that we should be published in these magazines. And a lot of volumes practice has been unwinding from what I think is supposed to be success and instead being really tuned into what intuitively I think it should be. And there's part of me that thinks that quality over quantity is better. I would rather affect 100 people in a way that they never forget it for their whole lives than design an app that 1 million people download that is just this transactional thing that allows you to get a car instead of walking somewhere. And so I would say that, like, I want to make sure that that's front and center. The quality of the interactions that I enable is much more like emphasized and maybe actually happens than, oh my God, I built this giant thing, or I built this thing that 1 million people bought, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, to me, it's going back to that one-to-one thing. They got to fix that one-to-one thing, right? And I want to be in the front lines of that in my work as much as I am a person. So.
I love that. So we have Pedro Ruiz in the audience, and he works a lot as a AI engineer. He has a fancy title that I'm butchering. Sorry, Pedro. And he is asking, what is the number one way you'd love to collaborate with AI? What is the biggest limitation you've found right now to consistently use it in your creative process? And with AI for Pedro, that's not just generative AI, that's all AI. Yeah.
That's a great question. Way to end it on a tough one. You know, I think it goes back something a little bit to what, there's two things, I think. One is, if it could be a lot more helpful with more systematic kind of applications of design, as opposed to these sort of, or anything, as opposed to these one-off sort of things, and not being a black box about it, like actually revealing, like, here's from your prompts or whatever, why I generated these kind of systems, whether it's like an entire book or an entire program for wayfinding, I don't know. I think the other thing that would be really good, and I don't know how you do this, right? But it would be awesome if AI, there was like enabled in your design work, like, hey, here's this ethical layer. If you do this, you're going to waste this much material. You shouldn't do it. Or if you send this message out, you know, it's going to be toxic to this kind of audience. You know, if there was like an ethical sort of kind of environmental slash sustainability ethical layer to this thing that would help improve that a little bit more, man, I'd be stoked. Like I always joked that like Twitter, if Twitter had just put this little thing in that said, hey, by the way, you're sending something really inflammatory. We're going to hold this for an hour just to make sure you really want to send this. The world would be so much better. You know what I mean? I just feel like that layer of technology is just that ethical friction layer. It's like, why can't we get that right? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if there was a way to like, I was designing something and I put it into the AI and they're like, look, if you do it this way, you're going to like waste all this material because we're doing stuff now that uses a lot of material. But if you just made this one little change, you know, it would save this much sort of, you know, carbon offset, whatever the right term is that I'm using. That would be awesome. Right. And maybe this is already happening. I don't know. I'm not an AI sort of, I'm not immersed in it like you are, but man, that would be cool.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, steal that term. Go ahead. Ethical friction. That is yours, baby. Just make it happen, Pedro.
Oh, well, Eric, it has been an absolute delight to talk to you again.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you for coming. And I want to thank everybody for participating in our podcast. If you want to know more about Eric, we have links here in the chat. You can also find him, Eric Hyman, at Volume Inc. And where else can people find you, Eric?
VolumeSF.com, TBDCCA.com. Eric F. Hyman is my kind of personal Instagram, and Volume Incorp is the Instagram for our volume. I am not good on the socials, but you can at least find me there. So,
yes. And where can they find your writing and your articles?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have recently published some articles on this great website called Scratching the Surface.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's scratchingthesurface.fm. It's a really great resource for design criticism. This Jarrett Fuller is a one-man kind of machine in terms of an institution for that. I have some other writing, older writing on Design Observer. And there's a really weird magazine called Plasticone. I think you can find it at Barnes & Noble or Order, where I designed and wrote kind of a whole sort of manifesto for design as well. So
right.
Thank you for highlighting that.
You're welcome.
Yeah.